Pacifica Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, the multiple dangers of direct contracting entities. Remember that name. It could cost you your life, especially if you're over 70. Also, we'll take a look at what's going on with the new Mexico policy and one woman's battle for prisoners' rights and protections. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We broadcast to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network, coming to you out of the San Francisco Bay Area. Thanks for joining us tonight. It's good to have you with us. We begin with an analysis of a program that I knew very little about, but it can affect some 30 million of us. I'm talking about direct contracting entities, DCEs, places like Humana. This is part of the privatization of Medicare, Medicaid, and we want to talk about that with Kay Tillo. Kay Tillo is chair of Kentuckians for Single Payer Healthcare. Welcome to Flashpoints, Kay Tillo. It's good to have you with us. Could you give us a basic explanation of what this direct contracting entity or these entities are? What are they and how do they affect so many of us?
Well, that's not an easy thing to do, but let me give it a try. Direct contracting entities is a program under the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and it's carried on by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. That's a part of Medicare that was placed into the law under the Affordable Care Act. And that center, the Innovation Center, is running models supposedly to save on cost and to improve care if they can, improve quality. But basically, it's designed to save cost. And the problem is that those people within that center under Medicaid think that the problem with cost is that people are getting too much care. So they design programs to try to squeeze out the overuse, what they see as overuse, what we would see as necessary care. So there is a program begun in April of 2021, and 53 direct contracting entities were approved. They are venture capitalists, they are hedge funds, they are insurance companies, they are the owners of for-profit physician practices, and they are now operating by putting people in Medicare into their programs without the consent of the senior who has been placed in that program. And then they have changed the form of payment from fee-for-service to instead a capitation, whereby the for-profit entity, this middleman, will get additional money if they deny care. And that's the tragic situation that we are in, that these are the seniors who have chosen traditional Medicare, not the Medicare Advantage plans we see, but traditional Medicare. Those are the ones who are being placed without their consent into direct contracting. And these Wall Street entities are looking to make a fortune off of it. And if they succeed, they will destroy Medicare entirely. That's the dire situation that we face.
You know, I hear that word capitation, and I think of decapitation, as in being decapitated from our traditional health care, and how this really can be problematic for seniors, because they don't even have to be notified. They are simply switched.
Well, what they call it aligned. And
aligned.
Aligned, right. That's really a strange thing. But
yeah.
They put you into it, and they are supposed to send you a letter. But, you know, it's one of those very, very complicated letters. And there doesn't seem to be a way to get out of it unless you leave your physician and go to a physician practice that isn't in one of these. But how people are really supposed to know is, it's really bad. And what it changes the way they are paid to a annual fee paid per month per member, which means that they change the incentive to less care.
And that's the heart of the matter, right? They change the incentives to make it, to motivate the corporations to cut people off. The more they cut them off, the less care they give. The more they deny, the more money they make.
Right. And, well, there are other ways in which they make money. The other way that they make money is by something called upcoding. I mean, this language doesn't make sense to most people, but the Medicare Advantage plans are paid more if they can assert that the patients are sicker. So they change you from being a little bit of a diabetic to a very a very difficult diabetic. In other words, they upcode, they change, they make up more code. Money if they can show, not show, but just assert that you are sicker and that you have more problems. So, for instance, they can go from $4,000 annually to $38,000 annually for you as a patient, depending upon how they code you. And so they're getting very, very good at precise upcoding, at saying that, you know, you're obese, or not only are you obese, you're morbidly obese, or,
right.
You know, that your diabetes is the kind that is really difficult, or your congestive heart failure is, all kinds of incentives to upcode. And we've already had Medicare Advantage plans have been defrauding Medicare and being overpaid by the billions. Well, this is going to be the same kind of a system. They'll be overpaid by the upcoding, they're overpaid by the capitation, and the patients are underserved by the incentives within a capitation system. So it's really a crisis, because, you know, these are the ones that have the people that have resisted going into the private plans. We now have about 42% of our people are in Medicare Advantage plans, already privatized. And that system is bad enough, because that has been set up so that people pay a monthly rate that is lower for the premium if they get into the privatized plans. But once they get sick, that's when they really get hit with the bills and the things it doesn't pay for and the doctors it won't let you see and the things that are out of the network. And so we have, you know, these a double whammy, Medicare Advantage privatizing, and now the people who chose not to be in that being put without their consent into direct contracting. And the worst thing about it is that this Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, they can make these models that they're experimenting with now permanent without congressional approval. CMS has the ability to do that. And that's why there has to be a massive protest to Xavier Becerra. He is the head of Health and Human Services, and he could stop this.
he could stop this. And he's a California native son, sort of, and he really could influence what's going on here. But what you're saying at this point, some 30 million seniors and disabled people are looking down the barrel of this gun, and oftentimes we don't realize it. I mean, I'm an investigative reporter, and I didn't understand until very recently that this was one of those things that was the driving force between the people who were willing to sort of settle for Obamacare and those who said it could be nothing short of single payer. This is the corporate part of Obamacare that essentially turns the medical care system back to the corporations, right?
It does indeed. I mean, we already had, within the Affordable Care Act, set up the exchanges, and now the people who must purchase on those exchanges, if they don't have subsidies, those rates are very high. We know people who pay as much as $26,000 a year to insure two people. I mean, so we have rates on the exchanges in the Affordable Care Act that are beyond people's ability to pay. And so we now have the situation of people who are insured who still cannot afford their care because of the deductibles and copays. So that part was a problem, but this part that sets up this experimentation with Medicare and threatens to privatize the entire program threatens every senior, threatens everyone, threatens the best program that we've ever had. You know, Medicare has always operated on an overhead of about 2% or less, and the private insurers have an overhead of 12 to 20%. So once you get the private insurers in there, you are spending more and more on making the profits and less that goes to care. So it really, we are faced with a crisis, and the tragedy is that most people don't even know that it exists. They're not even aware of it. There are 53 of these entities now operating, and they're operating in 38 states. So, you know, not everybody's in one yet, but enough people are. And if they decide to make this a program that they want to expand to all of Medicare, then they have the ability to do that without a vote in Congress. So we really need to get Becerra to stop it. We need to say end it, and we need to for people to contact their congressperson and say help us to stop the DCEs. You know, there were four congresspeople, including Katie Porter, I think she's from California, and Mark Pocan, and Pascrell from New Jersey, and Doggett from Texas, who wrote to Xavier Becerra and asked him to stop the DCEs and complained about people being automatically put into Medicare Advantage type plans that would deprive them of their rights. And so far as I know, they didn't even get a response. How can that
be? No response.
Well, the last I heard, I mean, it could have happened in the last couple of weeks or so. But so far as I know, there hasn't been a response.
Well, now, we'll follow up on that, and we'll see if there's a policy statement or some kind of acknowledgement about what is going on here. Now, you mentioned that there are a bunch of these corporations all over the country. Could you just give us a couple of examples? You mentioned Humana, I think, in the press release. What are their records? How have they in the past done taking care of people, looking out for elderly people? What kind of track records do some of these corporations, do we know? Do they have to have a requirement to be able to offer care, or lack thereof?
Well, you know, I think that it's astonishing the extent to which these companies commit fraud, defraud Medicare, and then they pay a fine and they continue to function. And, you know, we see it happen over and over and over again. Humana's paid a lot of fines. They've been found guilty, you know, of defrauding Medicare, and they continue to function. All of these folks continue to do it. You know, we saw Rick Scott with his Columbia HCA, you know, back, well, that was in maybe the 90s. And, you know, they paid a fine of $1.7 billion, and he went on to be the governor of Florida, and he's now in the Senate. And so, you know, there isn't any...
You know, I think another governor of Florida got in trouble, too. His name was Jeb Bush, and he got ensconced, I believe, within the private medical establishment, rip-off corporation. It sort of came up in one of his elections. Anyway, go on. Sorry I interrupted you.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that.
All right.
But, I mean, these entities are not even healthcare entities. They're hedge funds and venture capitalists. They're because there isn't any agreement that we ought to have healthcare professionals in charge of the healthcare. That there is this strange desire to put for-profit entities in charge because they think that will squeeze out the excess care, which they're trying to do. And it's really tragic.
Yeah, and of course it's part of a real move towards privatization within the government. It's very troubling, and it is really quite troubling to see this coming at us from the Democrats, and that you've got Obama, you've got Biden sneaking this in, getting behind this. Obviously, it's not surprising because he came in as vice president with Obama and he sold that plan. But again, it really alerts us also to the importance of fighting for single payer, for fighting for health care that really makes sense for the majority of people living in this country. Any other final information, perhaps questions we didn't ask you, things you think we should know about this?
Well, I think it is possible that if people know about this, that there will be an uprising that would be powerful enough to end it. I think short of that, we are really sunk, not only with a privatized Medicare, but ending our chances to move to an improved Medicare for all, a single-payer plan, to come into a kind of system that would give everybody care with no payment at the point of service and end the terrible discrimination and unnecessary suffering and death. So we have to fight it, and I would say people should take heart and take it on. And let Becerra and your congressperson know that they should end direct contracting and protect Medicare and boot out these Medicare Advantage plans that are ripping us off as well.
All right. What are some good email addresses? How do people get in touch with you if they want to learn more about your work or the folks who are working in their neighborhoods, in their neck of the woods, their part of the country? What's the best way to follow up?
Well, we have at kyhealthcare.org, and it's www.kyhealthcare.org. That's an organization, Kentuckians for Single Payer Healthcare, and you can get in touch with us through that. There's a group called National Single Payer, and you can find those people on the web as well. They're working on it. Physicians for a National Health program, PNHP.org. They are also working on it. They made an attempt to deliver petitions to Secretary Becerra on Tuesday, and they found no one to accept their petition. So we have a lot of work to do to make our government listen to the people.
All right. We're going to leave it right there for now. But we thank you for this very good information about a subject that's really important and is going to affect tens of millions of us in one more privatization operation, this time of the crucial Medicare system. It's really troubling. Knew very little about it, but believe me, we're going to be back with more. We thank you for joining us, Kate Hillo, and do come back sometime soon. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
You're so welcome. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to talk to somebody who has been fighting for prisoners, including members of her own family. This is an amazing woman, and we're happy to have her back with us. Stay with us. To Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And, first time I met this woman over the phone, I was incredibly impressed. This is somebody who's really on the front lines fighting for prison reform, fighting for to save the lives of prisoners. Jamalia Land, she's an organizer, she's a reporter, she's an activist, an amazing woman. Welcome back to Flashpoints, Jamalia Land. It is good to have you back with us again.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you for having me. I wanted to tell you real quick.
Go on.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Please go right ahead.
So my husband Samuel is on the line. He was able to call in. This is his call time. So he is actually here present with us.
And where is he calling
this
from?
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Samuel?
Yes. Greetings, Dennis.
Nice to meet you. Please speak up. And congratulations. I understand you just got your BA. That must feel pretty good. How did? What was that like?
I did. Thank you very much. And it's also a pleasure to meet you. And it's very exciting, you know. During the course of getting the BA, I didn't actually realize how historical it was, the feat that we were accomplishing. It wasn't until afterwards, when everyone began speaking about it and it started going viral, that I realized what we had actually done, not only for ourselves, but also for rehabilitating the image of people who are incarcerated also.
What was your major?
Communication studies, with an emphasis on organizational communication.
Well, that's a good place to go if you're looking to, you know, make a statement, if you have something to say, or if you want to help other people who have something to say. Jamalia, let's bring you back into this conversation. Would you talk a little bit about, just so people understand something of your background, the kind of work you've been doing in the context of both your family and on behalf of all the prisoners that are struggling to stay alive in the midst of some pretty difficult and dangerous situations?
Yes, sir. Well, thank you for asking. So my name is Jamalia Land. I am the proud wife of Samuel Nathaniel Brown, who is the original author of the proposal that became ACA 3, the California Abolition Act. So between myself and Samuel, we do a tremendous amount of work in regards to humanizing prisoners, and that prisoners are in fact people too, and so we tackle pretty much anything that comes our way that is a problem for those of our loved ones that are on the inside. So for example, ACA 3 came about because of COVID-19 inside of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. In addition to COVID-19, there were the issues of wage, him not being able to refuse to work and how he would have been punished for that via 115 and how it could have impacted his ability to be able to be a for parole, and then all of these various things. And so my son, as you know, is currently incarcerated. He is serving 3 consecutive life sentences for a crime that he did not commit. In addition to the boots on the ground work that we do, we do a lot of legislative work as well. And so I was a part of helping to get SB 1437 passed, which changed California's felony murder law, SB 1421, which now gives us limited access to law enforcement officers' disciplinary records, to AB 392, the California Use of Force Act, that was birthed out of, you know, years of deadly use of force incidents in California. And so we are always right in the middle and in the thick of it, because, well, my husband is incarcerated. My son is incarcerated. My father was incarcerated. Incarceration is something that unfortunately touches many, many people's lives. And oftentimes the solutions for the problems that exist within the carceral system do not come from those who are directly impacted by it. And so, you know, a lot of the work that Samuel and I are doing is about changing the trajectory in which we look at public safety and incarceration, and do the two go hand in hand. But most importantly, about humanizing people, because this is a dehumanized system that we live in, and we continue to treat people in inhumane fashions under the guise of public safety, and wanting to rehabilitate them in facilities that are not designed for that. And so I'm not sure if I answered your question or not, but that's a little about, you know.
You answered my question and raised many more. We have a limited amount of time, but I do want to hear from both of you the particular dangers that prisoners have faced in the context of 2 California disasters. One is a national disaster, COVID, and then there have been the fires. And I know that this has been a especially difficult time. Now you've got brand new COVID strain. I'm wondering, you must be a little edgy, Sam Brown. You're sort of on your way home, but here comes this new COVID. And even though the scientists aren't admitting it, they don't even know if their vaccine that they created for 19 is going to be good for 20 or COVID 4.0. So These are dangerous times, particularly for prisoners. So what's your thoughts on that? Let's start in jail, please.
Wow, that's a great question. Well, as Jamelia and I often say, mass incarceration is a smorgasbord for a pandemic. You know, you have recycled air inside of these buildings. There is no social distancing. You cannot escape. There's inadequate PPE, if any, that is provided. And after everyone broke their necks to get the Johnson & Johnson shot or the, you know, Moderna shot or the Pfizer shot, thinking that would be the end of it, and some people got booster shots. Now here we have the Omicron variant, and it's vaccine resistant. And so, quite frankly, that's terrifying all over again, especially in lieu of the fact...
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Especially in lieu of the fact that I personally had members of my class, as well as other friends that live next door to me, who passed away from COVID-19. So it's very real for myself. In addition to that, Dennis, I was the first person in the state of California, because I'm a healthcare facility maintenance worker and I'm also on the front line, that actually had to disinfect and sanitize a COVID-19 office where a staff member tested positive and a cell where a prisoner tested positive. So it really is, like you said, you know, terrifying, because we don't know what to expect, and it could come through here and ravage us at any moment. We don't know who's the next to die, who's the next to pass away. And the last time it took place like that was around this time last year. So here we are again, and it's ramping back up, and we don't know what to anticipate. And in regards to the flyers, you know, our son Eli would be best suited to really tell you about that. But something that Jamelia and I have been discussing and talking about is that they have no evacuation policies for incarcerated people, as if our lives are really just irrelevant. They have many policies and procedures to evacuate staff members if a financial disaster occurs in a prison, but they don't have any protocols to evacuate prisoners. In fact, I recently spoke to somebody who was in Pelican Bay when there was a tsunami warning, and the officers came through and put padlocks on the back of their doors to ensure that they would not open up, you know, that they could not get out, and then all the officers evacuated. So that's the reality of the
They locked them in? They padlocked them in? You said they padlocked them in?
They put a padlock behind the door to ensure that the door... First of all, we can't even open the doors, but then they turn around and put a padlock behind the door to make sure that nothing else will open the door in case of, I don't know what they think to open the doors, but we have no action at manually opening the doors, period. And so the padlock is just an extra extra mechanism put in place to ensure that the doors don't open. So that's our reality inside of the prison system when it comes to dealing with natural disasters as well as COVID-19. And I really thank you for asking that question.
I understand, Jamalia, that there is some good news, good family news. Do you want to share the possibilities that are coming up, or are you still going to be quiet? It looks like you two might be united soon, right?
Yes.
Am I not supposed to say that?
You're fine. You're fine. So back in August, Samuel was found suitable. And we are just waiting for the clock. We do not have an exact date or time, but we are anxiously awaiting the notification.
Well, I have a feeling. I know you already are quite the duet, the dynamic duet, but I suspect this communications operation, and you are, you are an award-winning journalist. Your work as a journalist, as an investigator, has been recognized, right?
Well, I won't go so far as to call myself a journalist, but I have had the opportunity to tell quite a few stories and be recognized for them. So
Yes, you have. Dennis, go on, please.
Thank you. I'm sorry for interrupting. I have to get off the phone to someone else's phone time, but I do want to say thank you for recognizing Jamelia's contributions to humanity overall and her hard work, you know, as an individual, you know, because she does so much, and she's an unsung hero, an uncommon hero, and she doesn't toot her own horn enough, if you ask me, but it's nice for her to be recognized, and I really appreciate you for doing it, man. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Be careful. Stay safe. We'll talk to you in person sometime soon.
I'm looking forward to it. And Jamelia, I love you.
All right.
I love you, too.
Right.
Call me when you can.
Okay. Okay, peace.
Yeah, that word love, we certainly need a lot more of that. So before we let you go, what's your number one focus? What are you lasering in on now in terms of the struggle to save lives behind bars? Where are you going now?
Well, you know, one of my main struggles has always been just humanizing the people that are inside these facilities, and getting people to understand that prisoners are people too. And that we need to start engaging our incarcerated population through more of a trauma-informed lens, and that is going to require us to change the narrative as to how incarcerated people see themselves, as well as how society as a whole deals with them. Because we know that, you know, giving someone a life sentence without the possibility of parole is nothing more than a sentence of death by incarceration. But how much safer is the public when we have an exorbitant amount of people who are serving life without the possibility of parole sentences, when we have people who are serving 20, 30 years on nonviolent or drug offenses, when we know that our facilities are full of people who are dealing with psychological issues or have experienced severe adverse childhood experiences and are dealing with complex trauma, right? And that these things have manifested themselves in a way in which people have chosen criminal behavior as coping mechanisms for what we as society have failed to address and deal with. And so for me, you know, we are all incarcerated, not just those that are behind the walls, but it's very important to educate the people and to humanize, because that's not PFN, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. That's my husband. That's someone's son. To someone's father, you know, and for us to start to really see people through the lenses of we are all human beings and what we are doing here in the United States of America, especially in California, the largest carceral state in the union, is in fact inhumane. And when you look at the UN and you look at, you know, the laws that are in place there, we are in direct violation of UN laws. With the way that we are handling our incarcerated population. So,
I am sure of that. And the United States is, if you will, known globally for being the leader in the percentage of people it puts behind bars. And it's also the most violent two-gun society in the world. We're going to leave it right there. But as always, it is an incredible pleasure to have you with us. Tell us how people, if they want to know more about your work, what you're doing, what's the best way for people to find out?
Well, thank you for asking, Dennis, and always a pleasure to talk with you. So people can go to endslaveryincalifornia.org. Again, that's endslavery, E-N-D, slaveryincalifornia.org. And it will take you to our website, and you can learn about what we are doing very specifically around ending involuntary servitude in the state of California and some of the work that we're doing on a national level.
Thank you so much for being with us on Flashpoints. Appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
All right. Stay safe. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're running a little bit late, but we wanted to share with you. We've got the final edition of the song that I wrote with Francisco Herrera. It's really a call to free Julian Assange. This is the final cut. worked with some incredibly beautiful musicians, including three all the way from Havana, fed into this piece. We are calling for people to free Julian Assange because he is one of the most significant publishers, radical anti-war publishers in the last 100 years. His work has been crucial in helping to stop and undermine wars. Here is our final edition. If you love it, share it.
Free!
As a journalist, I saw that we could achieve a lot of reform with a little bit of work. In some cases, one classified video can possibly stop a war.
A military chopper opens fire, instruments of genocide. WikiLeaks unmask the lie. By Central Command, gunsight video nails the murder scene down. Julian told the truth about the war machine. It's getting late in the hour, don't wait another minute to speak truth to power. Up in flames, Baghdad on fire. Julian Assange gave that a name. Lateral murder, a family shredded and maimed. Journalists die, who will remember their name? Is watching us. Which side are you on?
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, Free Julian Now. That's a song, first song I wrote in 40 years with my good friend, the great troubadour, Francisco Herrera. And you know the message there. Anyway, we believe in free speech here and free journalism, and we don't want journalists to go to jail. We are delighted to be joined by somebody who's both a journalist, he's a historian, wonderful knowledge of U.S. foreign policy in this hemisphere. His name is Robert Buzenko. He's a professor of U.S. foreign policy at the University of Houston and has extensive media experience and currently co-hosts the Green and Red podcast, which is which discusses politics and history. Bob, welcome back to Flashpoint. Sorry we're late. I am noticing that the Biden administration is poised to restart the Remain in Mexico policy. That's on top of the deportations under Title 42. This administration's foreign policy, read this hemisphere, is expanding to be more brutal than his predecessor, Donald Trump. Is that an exaggeration?
No, I also want to say that's really a beautiful song, and I really appreciate that. I think the left has been really absent in defending Julian Assange, so I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
And no,
thank you. Play it. Play it for your friends.
Go on, I'm sorry. Unfortunately, that's not an exaggeration as much as we would like to think that it is. You know, remember during the campaign, immigration and the situation at the border was a big issue, with Biden making all kinds of promises, and during the debate attacking Trump for separating families, and Democrats were talking about how inhuman Trump was, and Biden was talking about how important both legal and undocumented immigrants were to the U.S. And at one point he even said, it is not a burden, it is a gift. And now what we're seeing is, in fact, a return to the pre-COVID policies, the Remain in Mexico program, which really encapsulates the worst in immigration policy. It is a, you know, your previous guest was talking about violating international law with America's incarceration policies. America's immigration policies also violate international law. And so we're returning to that. We're seeing the worst of it. We're seeing brutality on the border. We're seeing brutality with these caravans in southern Mexico. We saw that a couple months ago in Texas with scenes that will be like reminiscent of the 1850s on a slave plantation at the border with Haitian immigrants. It really is a horror. And, you know, that's not even to bring into account the continued wars against Cuba and Venezuela, Bolivia, and so forth. So, yes, the long-winded answer there is, unfortunately, when it comes to issues like American imperialism and brutality and the appropriation of resources and things like that, this is where bipartisanship truly exists.
Long, strong wind of truth. We appreciate that, Professor. There are now reports of over some 1,500 murders, kidnappings, rapes, torture, and other attacks by Human Rights First. That comes out of the human rights group, Human Rights First. They tracked 2020 during the Trump administration, but it's only getting worse. They're talking about on November 30th, some 200 people, mainly families, were deported on planes back to Haiti. And my understanding of those deportations is many of those people are handcuffed into the plane. Some of those people have never been to Haiti or haven't been there in years. So it's brutal at all ends.
Exactly. Undocumented immigrants in detention have risen by 50% just this year under Joe Biden. And yeah, these are all violations of international law. You are obliged by international law to give somebody an asylum hearing. That's you know, you don't have to give them asylum, but you have to give them an asylum hearing within that country. So the U.S., by preventing them, by making them remain in Mexico, even if it's with the consent of the Mexican government, is still a violation of that law. Clearly they are, you know, abusing these people. They're coercing them to go back to places like Haiti. I mean, we saw that. We're seeing that all over. People who've never been in Vietnam are being deported to Vietnam. People who've never been in Colombia, I mean, so forth. So it really is an inhuman policy that violates all these standards. And it's clearly exposes that Biden just saw this. The Democrats, the liberals, just saw this as a campaign ploy, because they've become absolutely mute now that Biden is doing the things that they just were so apoplectic about in the previous 4 years, and there hasn't been much of a change, no.
And, you know, the continuation of Title 42, not only is it creating extraordinary misery, but really, for all intents and purposes, it ends the possibility of asylum, right? It's a beautiful excuse to deny asylum, or even the possibility.
Right. Right. It's, I mean, but, you know, going back to Obama, right? I mean, Obama deported, what, nearly 3 million people, I believe?
Right.
And so we've been seeing these kind of legal mechanisms used to kind of give a veneer of legal credibility to these programs, which really are just, you know, violations. I mean, the Democrats weren't quite as crude as yelling, build that wall, but they're using these other kinds of kind of legal and technical walls in the same way. To keep people out in violation of law, both international and American law, in fact. So yes, and the new, you know, returning to these new protocols is just a return to the worst excesses of both Obama and Trump, and both of whom were worse than George Bush. You know, that's saying a lot. So,
and the stay in Mexico policy. I'll say a little bit about that and the implications for sort of setting up thousands of people to be brutalized viciously attacked and used by every kind of criminal you can imagine.
Yeah, and that's happening right now. You know, according to international law, people have access to an asylum petition. However, the United States reached an agreement with Mexico, and the Mexican government said that they wouldn't even allow them to get to the northern border. So right now you have a large encampments, especially of Haitians, but other people as well. They're Venezuelans and Colombians and all kinds. But I think it's mostly Haitians in southern Mexico, in Tapachula province, which I think is not far from Chiapas, if I'm not mistaken. And there's significant levels of violence there from official Mexican agents of the state, the police, the patrols, the guardia, people like that, and also from, you know, bandits, from people who are, you know, preying on these people who are deprived, who are poor. There are sexual crimes, there are assaults, there are obviously, you know, these people don't have much, they're being robbed, they're being extorted. It's a human rights nightmare, and it's clearly based on violence, and the Mexican government is complicit in this as well. And you know, right now these people are being told that, you know, because they want to head north, and they're being told they have to remain in, they're being coercively held in these areas in southern Mexico. They're not being given, you know, adequate provisions, and many of them are being deported without any kind of hearing. So the Mexican government is clearly complicit in this as well, and who knows what they're getting for it. I mean, I'm assuming there's some kind of payoff there. They're making these claims that they're going to, you know, give them toothbrushes and COVID vaccines and, you know, hearings and stuff like that. There's a lot of, you know, fluff and kind of superficial cover for what is really a really horrific human rights situation, which is, I'm, you know, the weird thing for me is I'm not sure. The motivation to me seems just to be kind of, that's it, the cruelty, the violence. You know, it doesn't really kind of make a lot of, other than I think it's just power. It's placating a particular constituency here in the United States, you know, this ugly, xenophobic, racist group, because otherwise, you know, I mean, it's kind of ironic, right? The media keeps talking about a labor shortage. We don't have enough people doing jobs. One of the reasons for that is because immigration has been shut down so much. We've had, you know, like I said, 1.7 million border apprehensions this year alone. So you would think the ruling class would want cheap labor, right? But in fact, they're placating these really ugly racist sentiments in places like Texas and the Southwest.
I'm sure sooner or later they'll come up with some kind of new version of the Bracero program to use labor, extended use of labor and slavery without payment. That's, you know, but just to talk about the brutality of the policy, it has been in writing, as far as I can remember, in terms of in sort of the modern presidencies, it's Clinton, actually, the Clinton people actually put it into writing, the concept that the idea is to make it, if you make it harder, more brutal, more dangerous to get into the United States, it'll defer people from coming. But the only thing that's done is put more people at risk and cause more death, right? But that's been the program. Right. That's the concept. Make it difficult for them, and they won't come. But it doesn't work.
Right. And it's an intimidating factor. But of course, you know, as you know, it occurs at the same time that American policies, and in that particular case, NAFTA, are driving people off of the land in Mexico. So, I mean, NAFTA was incredibly destructive because it just ruined a lot of kind of middle level Mexican agricultural workers, you know, tomato farmers, for instance, they couldn't compete now with NAFTA. And so they're driven off the land. So the more that the United States is involved in these particular areas, then the more likely it is that you're going to create the conditions under which people want to leave. And then when they get to the border, you violently attack them. So these people are really caught in the worst kind of, you know, nightmarish situation where these global international economic, you know, these transnational institutions like NAFTA or like the WTO force you off the land. And then, you know, the United States institutes policies which intimidate you and tell you don't come here because it's, you know, we will harm you. And then when you do that, they harm you. And, you know, it really is just the, it's horrific. It's really kind of a death sentence for a lot of people simply for trying to survive and trying to survive with their families.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're speaking with Professor Robert Bozenko. He is a professor of U.S. foreign policy at the University of Houston, and we are always glad to have him with us. Professor, I'm going to take you to, like, domestic policies. Are you in Houston now?
Yes, I am.
What are the chances of there being I understand there's a candidate running for governor, a Democrat. What are the chances that O'Rourke has of being the next governor of Texas, or are we just going right all the way?
I'm never the person to talk to about this because I've been here for, I don't know, over 20 years, and since I got here people have been saying Texas is turning blue, right? And I mean, it's really an amazing state. The governor, yesterday courts have given the governor the okay once again to ban mask mandates. This winter there was a freeze and the state did nothing. 700 people died. You have this incredibly repressive anti-abortion law. And I mean, Beto O'Rourke will raise a lot of money, no doubt. He will raise a ton of money. The Democrats have a real problem here. They've for a long time now taken the Latina vote for granted, assuming that their policies on immigration, which we've just pointed out really aren't any different anyway, would win them votes. And actually Trump did quite well along the border last year. I mean, you know, there are long-term demographic trends. There are a lot of old white people in Texas, but you know, it's hard to see the GOP losing elections at this point. You know, Greg Abbott, the governor responsible, for instance, for the anti-abortion law, got 65% of the female vote the last time he ran. So, I mean, Beto O'Rourke is formidable. He will raise money. He obviously has national name recognition, but I'm not counting on a Democratic governor. I mean, people think I'm kidding or being a smart, but George Bush has been the most progressive governor in Texas since I've lived here. So that's what we're dealing with. So.
Okay. All right. We're going to leave it right there. Professor Robert Bozenko, as always, we appreciate you joining us on Flashpoints. Please stay safe. Come back soon.
Thank you, and I appreciate everything you do. Thanks so much.
All right. Same here. Bye-bye. And we're right against the clock. So I want to thank all of you for listening to Free Speech Radio, Free Speech Pacifica Radio, coming out of the San Francisco Bay Area over the mighty KPFA. We'll be back tomorrow. Hirschman.
And that people both older and younger than you, a billion strong, will say, we don't want you to make war anymore anywhere on Earth. If you do, we will stop you and your weapons of mass destruction without even a shot being fired. With a majority, you're an unruly child. Go to the corner and learn your lesson. Then, America, finally, you'll be free. Well.
Storytelling for social change on KPFA.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org.